There's been a sense for some time that the horse has already bolted when it comes to big tech regulation. And so governments and regulators are now really trying to play catch up with these companies.
The health of our democracies, the health of our economies, the health of our workplaces, public squares, they're just way too big.
I think inevitably it is going to be a multifaceted approach.
Tech giants wield significant power in our daily lives. The scale at which they operate and their innovative use of technology can lead, however, to challenges in keeping their power in check on a number of fronts. This podcast will assess the ways in which governments, regulators, lawyers, and the courts, as well as the tech companies themselves, through self-regulation, are currently attempting to do this. Rosa Curling is a director at Foxglove, a UK-based non-profit whose stated aim is to stand up to tech giants and governments and for a future where technology is used to benefit everyone.
We formed Foxglove because we felt like the power of the big tech companies was really going unchecked, and that there had been several of internal human rights boards set up within the companies, lots of internal reflection, but to put it very bluntly, nobody was suing them. And it actually felt very important that they got sued and asked to follow the rule of law, because certainly from our perspective, that the exercise of that power is now being used in an extremely harmful way. And the size of them means that the harm they're causing is kind of even greater. And we looked at the companies and also, of course, looked at what else everyone else was doing. And it felt like some, you know, the privacy issues were being kind of wonderfully covered by lots of different members and colleagues and friends in civil society space. But what we felt really was missing when we set up Foxglove, although I'm pleased to say I think that is beginning to change a bit, kind of 4 years ago, was that actually challenging their power wasn't happening. And we wanted to, the way in which we've been looking at that from a legal perspective, is to look at it both through a kind of labour rights angle, but also through a competition angle. Those are the two kind of legal frameworks in which we've been challenging that exercise of power. Because if we felt having the first kind of people that we spoke to when we started Foxglove were content moderators. Unions, if you look through history, have played an incredibly important role. And I think it doesn't even necessarily have to be within a formal union. The organising of these individuals, the people who are doing this work, are completely crucial. Our view is also the kind of antitrust competition law is also a space where you can try and, well, I mean, our ambition is to bust these companies up. They're way too big. The health of our democracies, the health of our economies, the health of our workplaces, public squares, they're just way too big. And it feels like competition law, whether it's in Europe or in Kenya or in South Africa or Brazil or the US or here, that actually that is also a space where the courts have a role and the state clearly has a role.
Ben Lasserson is a partner in the competition group at law firm Mishkon de Rea. He assesses the role of regulation and discusses key developments in the EU and the UK.
There's been a sense for some time that the horse has already bolted when it comes to big tech regulation. And so governments and regulators are now really trying to play catch up with these companies. It's actually, it's the EU really that's leading the way at the moment. The EU's Digital Markets Act recently came into force. And under that, the Commission can designate certain businesses as so-called gatekeepers, which provide core platform services. And this is very clearly aimed at the largest big tech businesses in terms of the turnover thresholds that they've put in place. And those gatekeepers are then subject to pretty strict prohibitions and obligations. And broadly, these are clearly aimed at trying to open up these closed ecosystems to facilitate third-party services, third-party access, interoperability with third-party services and systems in a way that can create greater choice and transparency for consumers. And also, interestingly, trying to change the way in which personal data can be used in circumstances where there's no consent from the individual in question. The Commission announced its designation of six gatekeepers. So we're looking at Alphabet, which is Google, Amazon, Apple, ByteDance, Meta, and Microsoft. And that is in relation to a total of 22 core platform services. those businesses have got to demonstrate that they are fully in compliance with all of those prohibitions and obligations under the DMA. And in parallel, the Commission's opened up a series of market investigations relating to Microsoft and Apple regarding certain other services that may or may not ultimately be designated. And that, I think, is really interesting because there are question marks as to what the enforcement of that act is going to look like. It's meant to run in parallel with existing competition law, but there are concerns from the big tech companies, certainly, that there shouldn't be a sort of double jeopardy. So that still has to be worked through. Interestingly, the UK, we've got the Digital Markets Competition and Consumers Bill, which is not yet law and is still going through Parliament. And that has a sort of similar, slight mirror image to the DMA. You can hear the echo. So rather than gatekeepers, the terminology is strategic market status businesses. But the objectives behind what they're trying to do, it's quite interventionist. The idea is that the CMA has a digital markets unit that will be able to directly sort of intervene with sort of codes of conduct and pro-competitive interventions. Closer scrutiny emerges, all with a view to trying to achieve more fair dealing, open choices and transparency for consumers. So you can see that the direction of travel is similar. But certainly the EU has moved pretty fast on this, actually, in the grand scheme of things. And that's going to be very interesting to see.
Michael Newman is a partner at law firm Lee Day. He considers the various approaches to regulation, including self-regulation, and gives an employment law perspective.
I think inevitably it is going to be a multifaceted approach. I think the idea that there'll be one tool that will fix everything here is probably short-sighted. And we've seen developments in terms of legislation. We look at the DPDI bill, Data Protection and Digital Information Bill going through Parliament at the moment. Legislation is one tool being used. We've also seen the adoption of things like the algorithm impact assessment that Institute of Future of Work has developed. So things that happen before rights would be enforced, you know, trying to integrate individual and systemic accountability. I mean, that's another very interesting way of approaching it. I mean, there may be scope for an ombudsman or some sort of scheme where you can voluntarily sign up to, you know, there are various charters, principles about good AI, things like that. And I think anyone in isolation is unlikely to be successful. But I think the most important thing to think about is if we think about other areas where self-regulation has, been successful or not, but has been used as a model. So if we think about freedom of the press, where it is largely self-regulated, the debate there was always, well, there's this really important principle, freedom of the press, that the government can't decide what stories are run or not, that we need to safeguard. And it's that principle that means self-regulation might have some benefits. What I haven't seen in this area is a convincing argument for what principle, what freedom is really important that the tech sphere needs that requires self-regulation. In fact, what we're seeing is they are important for a big chunk of the economy. They're important for a big chunk of people's livelihoods, which would suggest the opposite, that regulation is important. So I think it's just that counterbalance needs to be borne in mind when we're thinking about self-regulation and is it a good idea? Well, I think there's a real risk that regulation will get harder and harder. I mean, I think the first thing is we can see in some spheres that people are really lacking the sort of conceptual framework to talk about these things. That the world of work is moving beyond the legal world in terms of the ideas that we have. I mean, much of employment law is based around decision-making. You know, who makes the decision? What factors feed into that decision? How does that overlap? Or how does that sort of overlay on top of automated decision-making or algorithms or a partnership between the two, where there is some human input and some automated decision making. I think unless you start grappling with that early on, it becomes harder and harder to catch up, and it just means you're potentially failing a larger and larger group of people in terms of those who are affected by these employment practices.
Paolo Carrozza is a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame in the US, with a background in human rights law. He serves as a member of Meta's Oversight Board, an independent body created by the organisation. He discusses the board as one example of tech giant self-regulation and considers how it sits alongside other approaches to governance.
We already have a track record where we have had an impact on increasing transparency at Meta, on changing some of its policies regarding what it's going to leave up and take down. And so there is, I think, a tangible record that shows that regulation of this kind is feasible and helpful. The second dimension, though, I would say, is that I'm quite certain that that's only been possible in the work of the Oversight Board, precisely because of the very strong protection of independence that we have, and the quality of the members that make up the board. We're all there bringing different areas of expertise to bear. None of us are there to sort of be apologists for Meta. We're all there to try to increase its accountability, and because we understand that there are problems, but that we think that there are constructive solutions to many of those problems. And so it's, I think the structure and the institutional dimensions of it have an important impact on whether self-regulation is a constructive step or not. The third part of the answer, though, perhaps is the most important, which is I don't think any of us on the Oversight Board, and certainly not I, would ever say that self-regulation is sufficient. We would only acknowledge that and insist that self-regulation is one piece of an important set of collaborative actors in this space. So it goes hand in hand with a certain degree of baseline public regulation. It goes hand in hand with the sort of accountability and pressures that are brought by civil society organizations and so forth. And it's such a complex space and rapidly moving and large space that unless we have collaboration across these different actors, I don't think there's any hope of actually bringing the sort of improvements there that we all want to see. From a regulatory point of view and a state point of view, I would say that a regulatory scheme that does not take into account also the need for robust forms of self-regulation is simply not sufficient. The state isn't capable of keeping up with the technological changes, with the systemic aspects, with the scale of what's going on. So there needs to be sort of an active exchange of information where each of the parties is sort of saying, well, this is what we can do, and this is what we're trying to do, and how does it fit with what are the public interests that are being expressed through a legislation and the more sort of technical interventions of something like an independent oversight body.